Aquaculture and You, Creating a Sustainable Resource. A production of the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. Ask someone about aquaculture today, and though they may be able to define it easily enough, they might not be able to give you many details. In his 2010 book, Four Fish, author Paul Greenberg notes that people seem to have a vague awareness that fish farming is growing, but why, where, by how much, and through what means remain under the radar. Consumers' default assumption still seems to be that a fish on the plate is most likely going to be wild. This in spite of the fact that aquaculture is the fastest growing food production system in the world, and will likely surpass wild production within a year or two if it hasn't already. This podcast series intends to bring aquaculture onto your radar, and whether you're merely curious about the subject, trying to actively improve your consumer choices, or even if you want to try to start a fish farm of your own, you will find useful and timely information about this intriguing industry. And this industry will be absolutely critical for human prosperity in the coming century. According to the U.S. Department of Commerce, the United States is the third largest consumer of seafood in the world, and demand exceeds domestic supply from wild stocks. Currently, we import 84% of our seafood, and about half of those imports are from aquaculture. This results in a trade deficit for seafood of approximately $9 billion. Growth of domestic aquaculture would support fishing and agricultural communities, as well as new aquaculture-based industries in the United States. Those are the big picture numbers, but perhaps the most important thing about aquaculture is you. You matter. Your actions directly affect the aquaculture industry, which, as you will discover, lives and dies by consumer preference. In the course of producing this podcast series, I found myself looking much more closely at my own seafood consumption, with the result that I now enjoy a much greater and tastier variety of fish dishes at home, all the while knowing that I'm supporting American aquaculturists and sustainable wild fisheries at the same time. You'll understand how this works out as you listen to the upcoming episodes. Meanwhile, I am absolutely confident that with a small amount of effort, you too will be able to expand and enhance your own use of that mainstay of human happiness, a well-prepared fish. Okay, to best understand the current state of aquaculture, it is instructive to first look at its past in order to see why things are as they are. We'll first look at how aquaculture has developed historically, with a gradual emphasis on what has shaped our own corner of the world here in Wisconsin. As we approach the modern day, our focus will narrow to particular fish, people, and places in order to convey how aquaculture impacts you directly and to empower you to take productive action on this knowledge. We hope that you will continue to build on what you learn in these podcasts and pursue your own interests in aquaculture as far as they will take you. To liven things up, we'll include personal interviews and location audio, and throw in a few video podcasts as well. Finally, we'll close with an introduction to some of the latest developments in the field, examining the ways in which people are moving aquaculture forward in Wisconsin and around the Great Lakes in order to establish a nourishing and sustainable resource for the 21st century. From our headquarters here at the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute, we can provide a unique perspective on farm-raised fish, facilitated by the special relationship that Sea Grant has maintained with aquaculture since the organization was founded in the 1960s. That notable story and many more will all be revealed in Aquaculture and You, Creating a Sustainable Resource. Episode 1, Taming the Fish. Raising fish for food, rather than catching them from the wild, has roots in deep antiquity, and quite likely even earlier. Across many parts of the world, people developed various fish farming practices that were influenced by the different environments and fish stocks available to them. Today, we know that aquaculture is vital for our future, as the worldwide demand for seafood continues to increase, and wild populations of both marine and freshwater fish continue to decline due to overexploited catches. But what prompted ancient societies to raise fish in their far less crowded world? The answer is, in part, one of the reasons for our own increasing reliance on aquaculture. Predictability. For the modern industry, this often translates more to year-round availability and standardized fillet sizes for the market, But in earlier times as now, fish farming meant a steady supply of food. Currently, in many parts of the world, small-scale aquaculture still provides enhanced incomes and food security for numerous people. And though a comprehensive history of the multiple varieties of aquaculture practiced today is beyond the scope of these particular podcasts, this brief overview will explain what we know about the early development of fish husbandry and will help chart the historical events that have shaped the direction of the aquacultural practices seen today in Wisconsin and other parts of the United States. Recent archaeological evidence suggests that eels may have been systematically farmed in Australia as early as 6,000 years ago by indigenous people, and that floodplains in Bolivia may have been channeled to stock fish even earlier. Pictorial and archaeological evidence of stocked fish ponds found in Egypt and in ancient Sumeria date back 4,500 years, and certainly carp were being stocked in ornamental ponds in China by then as well. Most historical accounts of aquaculture usually focus on China, as this is where the earliest surviving treatise on fish farming was written. The Chinese loved carp. These colorful fish were enjoyed for their aesthetic value, and they were also raised for food, religious ceremonies, and enhanced social status. Carp were symbolic of good fortune and a sign of wealth. Such cultural perceptions greatly affected the path of aquaculture in China, and to this day, varying social valuations on both freshwater and saltwater fish continue to significantly shape the economics and choices of the aquaculture industry. Carp are still the number one fish cultured on fish farms now, and remain tremendously popular in China and across Asia. Okay, listeners out there in America are probably saying, wait a minute, carp? I don't see carp at the grocery store. The only carp I hear about are invasive species spreading up the Mississippi. Why didn't they raise salmon? Why did they pick carp? Good question. As it turns out, carp are remarkably hardy. They can survive in water with low oxygen so they can be easily transported, and they can live in small pools that do not have good water circulation. Water with high salinity doesn't bother them, they require no special food, and they can endure long periods of starvation. In other words, carp could handle the considerable stress associated with primitive forms of aquaculture, and most importantly, they're tasty. Or at least, the wild carp found in fast-flowing European and Asian rivers were. The ones transplanted to North America seem to have become somewhat unpalatable, perhaps due to the difference in habitats. However, this raises an important issue concerning aquaculture, which may as well be addressed now. A common consumer complaint heard about farm-raised freshwater fish is that they might taste muddy. The flavor of free-ranging fish is affected by their activities and environment, for many of the same reasons that wild pheasant are more flavorful than farm-raised turkeys. However, bottom-dwelling freshwater fish, such as carp and catfish, frequently absorb organic compounds known as geosmins, released when certain classes of microbes die. Geosmins give beets their earthy goodness and can often be scented when soil is disturbed, or after rain falls on dry earth. In fish, unfortunately, this earthiness becomes what we consider an off flavor. Humans are extremely sensitive to geosmins and can detect concentrations as low as 5 parts per trillion. Eliminating off flavors is a routine task for modern fish farmers, as modern aquacultural techniques can easily purge geosmins from their stock. However, if you should find yourself in a pinch with a muddy-tasting catfish you've reeled in yourself, the vinegar found in old recipes and fish and chips shops can reduce off flavor, as the acid will break down the geosmins. Okay, back to China. The types of agricultural environments that were developed early on in China lent themselves readily to fish cultivation. Low-lying and flood-prone areas were used for rice production, and the Chinese developed extensive irrigation systems to manage their rice fields. These irrigation systems were gradually expanded by a process of ditching and diking in order to raise a greater variety of crops, creating higher ground for horticulture and deeper ponds ideal for raising fish. And this is where aquaculture enters written history.
About 2,500 years ago, during the Zhou Dynasty, an industrious entrepreneur named Fan Li wrote a short book called Yang Yu Jing, or Treatise of Fish Culture, which explained how to successfully raise common carp. Fan Li had done quite well for himself, and he thought his writings could help others earn a good living through fish farming. His manuscript shared the details of fish pond design, and caring for immature fish, what we describe as fry or fingerlings. Certainly, 养鱼业, or aqua husbandry, was already a considerably refined occupation before Fan Li took the trouble to write his techniques down. 100 or so years later, another book, Youhou Bin, was published that explained how to integrate fish culture with the production of aquatic plants and vegetables, and other written and pictorial records from these times attest to such culturing of fish in rice paddies. For 1,000 years, the practice of breeding common carp for food integrated with agriculture thrived in China. Thus, aquaculture became a traditional part of early Chinese royal experience. However, during the Tang Dynasty, around 618 AD, an emperor came to the throne whose surname was Li, which also happens to be how the word for common carp is pronounced. The royal ministers decreed that any catching, killing, or eating of Li Yu would be a direct insult to the emperor's dignity. Consequently, the keeping and culture of common carp was banned for the next 300 years. This forced fish farmers to turn to other species, and they began raising silver carp, mud carp, grass carp, and bighead carp, often together. These four new species had different dietary needs that had little overlap, and thus all four types could be raised in a single pond. This is the source of the Chinese proverb 一个草鱼喂其他三个鱼, or one grass carp feeds three other fish, as the waste from the grass carp nurture the plants that the other species like to eat. This polyculture of fish made better use of feed and boosted overall production, and was a significant moment in aquacultural history. Eventually, the Chinese developed a very sophisticated form of integrated aquaculture, using fish ponds, dikes, and mulberry trees, which was able to provide fish and fruit for local consumption, manure for fertilizing fields, and silk for export, as silkworms feast on mulberries.
Integrated aquaculture systems have compelling interest for today's industry, and this topic will return later in the series when we look at aquaponics. Now, however, we turn our attention westward, for other people in antiquity also learned to harvest carp.
Distenet carpem Danuvius, Ereno veniat Ancorago. Sapori Pisces de diversis finibus efferantur, sic desit regem passere.
From the Danube come carp, from the Rhine come herring, flavorful fish from different ends of the realm, as it should be to feed the king. By the time Cassiodorus wrote these words in the 6th century, Romans had been feasting on carp for at least 1,000 years. Roman legions camped on the Danube found abundant wild carp in the river, and commanders with Epicurean tastes brought back live fish to Italy to enhance the variety and status of their patrician feasts. The Romans are known to have kept fish for extended periods in specially built ponds named piscinae. Classical literature suggests that this was a widespread practice throughout the Mediterranean, and remains of rectangular piscinae can be found at many archaeological sites in the region. In addition to carp, the Romans reared pike, bream, and eels, and are thought to be one of the first cultures to systematically develop coastal lagoons into holding ponds in order to have stocks of saltwater species such as mullet, lampreys, sea bass, and even shellfish and turtles. Many of these piscinae were quite elaborate, and their owners were sometimes criticized by writers of the time for their ostentatious displays of wealth. Even then, it seems like saltwater fish were considered more desirable than the freshwater fish that were more readily available to the common people, a perception often seen today. After the fall of the Roman Empire, the custom of keeping fish, like many other cultural practices, was carried on at monasteries throughout medieval Europe. Early Christian tradition held that only cold-blooded animals could be eaten on fast days, so fish were one of the few meats that were permitted. This tradition endures to this day in Wisconsin, where the Friday fish fry has been enshrined into local culture. With more than 100 days of fasting each year and heavy punishments for those who broke the rules, faithful Christians in early times had a vested interest in keeping a good quantity of fish at hand. Monks kept freshwater fish in what were called stew ponds for the winter months or other times when fishing was impractical. These stew ponds became the province and ultimately one of the privileges of the clergy and the nobility as well, who could keep fish in the moats around their fortresses. Peasants in Western Europe were often barred from fishing in rivers that were considered royal property, and poaching from stew ponds was a capital offense. Thus, the feudal system that deprived peasants of land ownership also frequently deprived them of fish. In Eastern Europe, however, community fish ponds were more prevalent, and it was here that the simple fish husbandry of medieval aquaculture was first expanded at the beginning of the Renaissance. During the late 1300s and early 1400s, economic growth and the increasing spread of knowledge through the written word began to impact the traditional methods of aquaculture that had been practiced in Europe for hundreds of years. Fish culture up to then had been mostly a hit-or-miss affair, limited to separate breeding ponds for rearing transplanted or trapped wild fry, and production ponds for the mature fish. The larger fish were taken for consumption, the smaller fish were used for stocking, and occasionally a stew pond might be breached in order to dig out the built-up silt. As far as we know, no attempts were made to produce fish for more than local consumption. But starting in the low-lying floodplains of what is now Hungary, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic, communities began to organize the construction and management of fish ponds at a much larger scale. Emperor Charles IV of Bohemia and Moravia mandated the building of hundreds of fish ponds around the towns of his realm, and Bohemian engineers responded, becoming expert at crafting man-made lakes and interconnecting canals, some of which have survived to this day. Many of these fish ponds were quite extensive, covering hundreds of acres, and large swaths of land were dedicated to the raising of fish. Mercantile trade in fish brought prosperity and civic pride to villages in Central and Eastern Europe, and fish culturing was firmly established there by 1500 and began to spread into Western and Southern Europe as well. Additionally, the life cycle of the fish, still mostly carp, began to be studied and applied to management, and yields increased. Books were written detailing techniques for intensifying fish culture, the first in Latin by Janus de Pravius, a Bohemian bishop and fish farmer in 1547. This work was reprinted and translated into several languages, including English. Remarkably advanced for its time, de Pravius's book, roughly translated as Of Fish and Feeding Them in Ponds, in 5 volumes, discussed breeding carp in great detail, and also had chapters on fish diseases, aquaculture economics, and the efficient organization of workers. Other books also appeared which shared information about fish and pond management, pond construction, preferred species for raising, and methods for feeding. The 16th century saw a peak in European fish husbandry, and interestingly, this coincided with a high point in culturing aquatic organisms across the world. However, by the end of the 16th century, fish farming began to decline in Europe. Certainly, the Reformation and its attendant wars disrupted the fish trade and the societies that supported it. Fast days were observed much less. Indeed, in England, where Catholicism was banned, the demand for fish fell so low that Queen Elizabeth had to institute an official, quote, fish day every Wednesday, which she stated was
meant politically for the increase of fishermen and mariners, and repairing of port towns and navigation, and not for any superstition to be maintained in the choice of meats.
The good queen did not want to be caught without a fleet or the means to build one. Ultimately, however, the reason for the waning of fish pond aquaculture in Europe was economic. Land was needed for animal pasture and for the intensive agricultural production required to feed growing populations. This, along with a long-term slump in fish consumption at all levels of society over the next 2 centuries, combined to make freshwater aquaculture unviable in most parts of Europe. Still, guilds of fishmasters in Bohemia and other areas would continue to practice their traditional methods of raising fish well into the 20th century. So this was the general state of aquaculture at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. A great variety of aquacultural techniques had been developed all over the world, though, as in Europe, the intensity of aquacultural practices had leveled off. And though of local importance, the global impact of aquaculture in terms of food production before 1950 was slight. As rivers and oceans still teemed with fish, aquaculture remained, for the very most part, a supplementary or small-scale source of a food that could still be taken from the wild without undue difficulty. Over the next 150 years, this situation would change drastically. But before moving on to the next part of our story, two important points must be noted as they will return as critical factors for the future of modern aquaculture. First, before 1800, traditional methods of aquaculture almost exclusively focused on freshwater fish. Furthermore, these freshwater fish were nearly all herbaceous. They lived off plants, or in the case of fish like pike, they fed on other freshwater fish. Because of this, pre-industrial aquaculture put no pressure on populations of ocean fish. However, as we will see, adverse impacts on saltwater fish stocks have become a major concern for aquaculture in the 21st century. Secondly, then as now, social perceptions greatly affect the practice and support of aquaculture and its products. How cultures value fish and their consumption, as well as how they view the methods in which they are brought to the table, will continue to significantly influence the aquaculture industry in the future, just as they have in the past. We'll look at these issues more closely in upcoming podcasts, but for now, we'll turn to the Industrial Revolution as we examine the roots of modern aquaculture in the next episode. Thanks for listening. This recording was produced by Chris Bocast for the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute, 2012.